Good evening. Well, everybody's on vacation midsummer. Welcome. A friend told me that a Dharma talk needs to have three elements. And one of them specifically has to do with the Dharma, which is a good thing. And another is about a personal dilemma, another element. And another is just a story. So I'm going to try that outline. So I was in my office today speaking with a new patient who told me that a flock of birds is following him around. And I'd heard that story before. Not in that office, but in a Dharma hall. And so I searched it out. I knew it was one of the transmission of the light stories. This is Kazan, a few ancestors after Dogen, put together all the enlightenment stories of the preceding ancestors, the lineage, our lineage, and the 23rd ancestor in India, Haklanayasas, he was a monk and he met the 22nd ancestor and told him the perplexing story that a flock of crows had been following him around. And the 22nd ancestor revealed to him that in Haklanayasas, previous life, many lifetimes before, he had been an abbot of a monastery, and they all trooped down to visit the Nagas. These were the underwater dragons that were guarding the wisdom sutras. And the Nagas determined that the abbot was okay, but the other monks weren't quite up to snuff for such a visit. And and so they didn't quite get to be reborn as humans the next time around. They became a flock of crows that just followed the lifetimes of Haklanayasas. And these were his former monks that continued to follow him according to the 22nd ancestor. And Haklanayasas says, well, how can I liberate them? And the 22nd ancestor said, just teach the Dharma. And he had this great awakening, and the crows became monks again, and he went on to become the 23rd ancestor. So I told my new client that he was going to be a great teacher, and he said he already knew that. So we were all on the same page. We just completed yesterday the 7-day transmission ceremony here at Santa Cruz Zen Center. Catherine transmitted the robe and bowl to Kathy Wilden, Hoshin Sozan, one of the longtime students in Monterey Bay Zen Center. And this time I was the attendant, kind of the stage manager for this great 7-day ceremony of chanting and bowing and eating so I saw it from a little different view. Years ago, I'd heard a talk by a teacher in San Francisco. I want to take on all the responsibility of not really understanding, but this teacher talked about the concept of transmission Zen. And I thought that was kind of elitist. I thought it was, you know, maybe something that's saved for a few special people. And I wasn't so interested in, you know, special. My brand of Zen was pretty ordinary. And I didn't give it much weight. I mean, in fact, I dismissed it, you know, as you can tell. But now that I've kind of bought the farm, so to speak, I have a completely different understanding. And especially, you know, being the attendant for this ceremony, it was pretty ordinary. It was just us chickens. It was just us. I knew all the players. It had that ordinary quality because, you know, we were right here, a familiar place, with people that I was pretty familiar with. But at the same time, it was pretty special too. And the special part of it is that it's not about the specialness of people. It's not about personalities, and that's always the, you know, at least one of the solutions to any koans that come up in your life, whether they're in koan books or whether they're the koans of your life. You know, you know you're on the right track when you can start saying, you know, this isn't about me. It isn't about personalities. It isn't about them. It isn't about that person. It's pretty universal. It's pretty ordinary. It's just about causes and conditions. And what these ceremonies that are ordinary and special at the same time are about is just recognizing that the Dharma has once again splashed onto our shores. Everybody in this room represents the 93rd time that Zen centers have been built and maintained, and people have gotten to know each other in a very different, special way. People have gotten to know their lives, or people have understood their lives recognize their lives as the interconnectedness of all things, or as we were talking last week, I was really moved by how Kathy spoke about the practice of patience and that image of Dogen's of, you know, not only are we dancing in the waves, or not only are we the waves on the surface, but we're also, you know, our feet walking on the bottom of the ocean. So we're the 93rd time that that we've become aware of that. Yes, we're all of that. It's like a clock. It's just marking of the causes and conditions, that ceremony. 93 times. You know, the Zendo was formed, you know, maybe on the 91st time. And we've been taking care of it now for a couple of generations. That's what that ceremony is, just a marking of the generations, 25 years or 20 years, whatever we call a generation. So I think, you know, 6 months ago when I was doing the ceremony, I think I was pretty much, as much as I tried, it was pretty stimulating. I was up here, you know, dog paddling for all I was worth. I think this time around, I could feel my feet, you know, in the sand. I said a little bit of this to Catherine, and working with a teacher really is about helping become grounded. I think even in saying this to Catherine, I was kind of euphoric. I was kind of up here still. You know, this is just our hearts, I said. This is just our bodies that we already know. And Catherine reminded us, and it's also our confusion, reminded me. It's also our crabbiness. It's also our difficulties. But it was familiar and ordinary and special at the same time. Those are two of the three elements of tonight's talk. The seventh ancestor in India was Vasumitra. He was the town drunk. He was clever and the town drunk. and that might not be such a healthy combination. He would sometimes sigh or howl. People thought he was crazy. He did not let anyone know his name. So Kazan tells the story of his awakening. He placed his wine vessel before the venerable Mishaka, the sixth ancestor. Mishaka asked him, "Is this vessel mine or yours?" Vasumitra thought about it, and Mishaka said, "If you think it is my vessel, it is your intrinsic nature. If you think it is your vessel, you will receive my Dharma." Hearing this, Vasumitra was greatly awakened concerning the unborn intrinsic nature. So, Blanche talks about this particular translation by Francis Cook. She says, "These stories of the moments when earnest practitioners experienced directly non-dual reality are an inspiration for us all to discover our own light." So that is a clue again that these koans or enlightenment or some sort of non-perceptual understanding of the non-dual nature of all things rests in the merging of two sides. When we were here a month or so ago talking about another koan, we were talking about the Buddhist concept of purity, which is related to this non-dual business, that things are called impure when you can recognize something about it, you know. And in this case, this vessel, he was asked to, you know, recognize, you know, is this mine or is it yours, you know. So there was the ownership part. You could recognize ownership. So later on, Mishaka, the sixth ancestor, says that what's before me here, this vessel, is an impure vessel, and then gives him this koan. "At the very least, I want you to wrestle with the concept of, is it mine or yours?" Kazan goes on to tell. So this is what Kazan has done. He's recounted these enlightenment stories, and then he gives a Dharma talk on his understanding of what the story was about. Kazan goes on to talk about the purity of this vessel, and that was Vasumitra's koan, is about purity. And when he understood the nature of that vessel, is it mine or is it yours, the vessel disappeared. And one who is truly a pure person does not establish purity, and for that reason also does not establish a vessel. The paths of teacher and disciple coincide because there is no obstacle on the path. You will receive my Dharma because it is your intrinsic nature. Not one thing is received from someone else, and not one thing is given to another. Kazan ends with a poem in all of these. Just as an echo follows when a bell sounds on a frosty morning, so here from the first there is no need for an empty cup. So if Vasumitra was living in a world of up here, rattling around town, sometimes the vessel was full, sometimes the vessel was empty, sometimes he was howling because it was full, sometimes he was howling because it was empty. His teacher helped him see that with our feet on the bottom, we always have what we need in this moment. With these causes and conditions, there's no emptiness or fullness. This cup that was measuring emptiness and fullness no longer had that distinction. You couldn't see those characteristics, and so naturally the cup just disappeared. This wave of Dharma that we've met for the 93rd time is pretty ordinary. It's just about meeting another person. It's just about settling in with other people that are have taken on, or not, that have also experienced the settling in into their bodies, down completely to the feet on the bottom of the ocean. It's just about us chickens that we know, that we see day after day, that are pretty ordinary and yet also pretty extraordinary, this practice. The concept of purity has that element of transformation in it. That when it's not really this, when it's not really that, when it includes both this and that, it's transformed into something else, something extraordinary. That's what this meeting face to face with our teachers, sitting side by side with our Sangha members does. It's pretty ordinary. We know how to meet people face to face. We know how to sit quietly next to each other. But the combination of that is pretty extraordinary. It makes us live in our entire bodies. That makes us, it allows us to recognize our entire bodies. That's the important line there. And I keep tripping on it. This business of you can't make purity. How is it said in here? Does anybody remember? One who is truly pure does not establish purity. There is effort involved in this practice. But it's not like we're trying to make things pure. We come into the room, we sit down, and occasionally we're aware of what already is. This unification. Any thoughts? Any ideas? Jane.
I have a question. I'm not sure of the significance of the 93.
Catherine is the 92nd ancestor from Shakyamuni Buddha. And the latest Dharma heir, Hoshin Sozan, is the 93rd ancestor. So I am contending that this is just the 93rd time that, you know, we as a community have come together, you know, met to practice the Dharma, to keep up the Dharma, to value this place as a place that not the only place that we can find the Dharma, but sort of the source, Hoshin Sozan, mountain source, ocean heart. That this actual physical place and the actual physicality of our bodies and our meeting with the teacher is the manifestation of the Dharma, of this non-perceptual life that we lead in the universe, of waves and tidal forces all at the same time. We've done this 93 times is my contention.
I guess I get confused because I read the other part of the transmission where I did a class with Fulon, and it seems like there's, you know, the historical ancestors. And of course he stops with himself, and I forget what number he was.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get a little confused about our current kind of, you know, since Soto came with Suzuki, and there's various and sundry people that have received transmission. And do each one of those people, since it's several are in one generation, and yet in the historical text, it's about there's many students, mm-hmm. but only one of them is given the robe. And is considered to be enlightened, you know, receives enlightenment. or is awakened, I should say. So I'm a little, I haven't quite figured out how our current day thing fits into that. You know, I know we have it on our bloodline.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, maybe you can, I don't know if that's relevant or not, but.
Well,
you can talk to me later if it's not relevant to this.
So every Dharma heir, you know, begins a new branch, and that every Dharma heir after that, you know, with that, you know, one Dharma heir, you know, goes on a little different, you know, branching streams, and that's what they've named the Suzuki Roshi organization is all of us branching streams. But you know, historically they say that that things started to branch with the sixth Chinese ancestor, and that there was sort of only one up until him, and then he acknowledged that all of his heirs held the light and the lamp. And but you know, my sense is that, you know, it was always the same way. I mean, I imagine that, you know, the Buddha we hear about, I could be speaking heresy here. I'm making this up. He got the bull on the road, but he had hundreds of students, and was the only place to study it, you know, right from Kashyapa then. What about all those other students? They must have established little Zen centers. I can't imagine it was ever any different than the way it is right now, but we can establish this path because it's been written down on the lineage papers, you know, all the way back to Buddha. I'll have Kokyo erase all of this if I've spoken heresy, or I'll be a rogue lineage, a heretical lineage. Yes.
Can you say something about purity? What is it? What is the one who is truly pure?
Yeah. Well, that's that concept of, you know, characteristics. If you can identify characteristics, it's not pure. So if you've got the mind that there is this and that there is pure and impure, and that my practice is to start seeing the interconnectedness of all things, then while you're kind of going in the right direction, if it's this conscious thing that you're trying to do to establish, that you're going to get stuck. So the idea is just to keep practicing.
You mean consciously trying to separate the pure from the impure?
Yeah, or if then to sort of just go with the pure. You're going to get stuck. So the idea is just to practice, you know, over and over again, as we chant in the morning, just stop talking and thinking, just dropping those thoughts and ideas after another. So it gets to be pretty easy. So things don't get, so those barbs of this and that aren't getting stuck. If you just keep practicing, dropping thoughts and ideas, so you get pretty good at it. And you can, that things might happen, not that you're going to identify them, but this body and mind will experience the interconnectedness, the unity of the waves at the top and the feet on the bottom, which is the way things always are. It's hard to talk about, because we have to use concepts, but I think we keep coming back here because we are familiar with this body that can experience this moment fully, this body and mind fully, when we can just keep letting the thoughts drop off. I think we say, just like we say to each other, that's familiar. I know that feeling. I know that body and mind, and we want to keep visiting it. Carolyn.
I recently had an experience of the sort that you have been describing this evening. I was in Auckland, New Zealand, to attend a writers' festival. The very first thing that happened was a welcoming ceremony by the Maori group on whose land we were attending the festival. I went to the Maori welcoming ceremony. We were summoned into their marae, which is their meeting house. When I stepped inside, it felt so familiar. It felt like this place. It had carvings and other kinds of things that we don't have, and yet the space of it felt perfectly ordinary, in the sense that I think you're using the word, and at the same time extraordinary. Here we were, a group of foreign writers being welcomed by the Maori, speaking in their language, then speaking in English. This led up to the culmination of their welcoming ceremony, in which each of us walked down the line of our hosts. And we did the hongis, nose touching, and it's an exchange of breath. And some people, quite understandably, felt a little on edge, however, we just walked up there, walked along the line, and it seemed both ordinary and extraordinary, but what I didn't think about at all was, after each touching of the nose, I did this, and my Maori hosts then did the same. It seemed natural. After the ceremony, they offered us a wonderful tea with some of the best things I've eaten in a long time, including some fabulous little fried fish. And we all felt that we were indeed interconnected, although we were quite unfamiliar to each other until that ceremony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. And ceremonies do kind of help us drop down into shared territory. You know, when we were chanting up there on the stage with the Japanese Cultural Festival Fair, you know, in our chants in one voice and one body. We all, I mean, you might all think about, you know, what that experience is that in your mind and body that keeps you coming back to the Zendo. And I've said this before. The pretty ordinary experience of when I just can reach up in the cupboard and pull out the teacup with both hands and experience the weight of the cup, experience that I've brought my whole body, you know, into that act, rather, and not to put it down, but as we sometimes do, is, you know, we're turning on the rinse water, reaching up to get that cup. This is, you know, when I'm experiencing my whole body effort and my whole mind, you know, into this act, there just seems to be a spaciousness and openness. And that's my little light. That's my little light shining that keeps me coming back. And I have it on the cushion. I have it, you know, chanting in ceremonies. Is that passed on? Was that given to me by my practice? Was that given to me by listening to Catherine's lectures over the last 19 years? Was that given to me by the camaraderie, you know, that I feel with all of us here in the Sangha? It's hard to say that was given, but something happened that I started paying attention to it by coming here, and that it was familiar. And, you know, this little light shining, this enlightenment, is pretty ordinary. It's just about teacups. So, anyway. Thank you.
Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are impossible.